Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin from Chicago, home of Mishkin Law. If you're interested in a little representation in the world of marijuana, give a call and we're always happy to help. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about today a Grateful Dead show from March 18th, 1977, 47 years ago today, from the Winterland Auditorium or Arena or Ice Skating Rink or whatever the hell they called it in San Francisco. It's a great night. There's some great stuff played, and we're going to get into it right now. So just a month after the Swing Auditorium show that we previewed a few weeks ago, the Dead went home to Winterland 47 years ago for a string of shows. This one stands out for a few reasons, not the least of which is this really awesome Sugaree that checks in as the fourth song of the first set, opening with Promised Land. Significance there we'll get to in a minute, because this show kind of bookends Chuck Berry tunes. Mississippi Half Step, It's All Over Now. Used to Love Her, But It's All Over Now, as opposed to It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, and this Sugaree. So the fourth song in, they're really cranking on it. 15-minute version of the tune. The half step was 12 and a half minutes long. So they really came out firing on all cylinders for this one. Sugaree, we've listened to a lot on this show. Song with lyrics by longtime Grateful Dead lyricist Robert Hunter. Music by Jerry Garcia. Written for Garcia's first album, solo album, Garcia, which was released on January 20th, 1972. As with the songs on the rest of the album, Garcia plays every instrument himself except drums, played by Bill Kreutzmann, including acoustic guitar, bass guitar, and an electric guitar played through a Leslie speaker. Released as a single from the Garcia album, Sugaree peaked at number 94 on the Billboard Hot 100 in April 1972 and was Garcia's only single ever on that chart. Elizabeth Cotton, a North Carolina folk singer, wrote and recorded a song called Shake Sugaree in 1966. The chorus of Cotton's song is, "Oh Lordy Me, Didn't I Shake Sugaree?" Hunter was aware of this song when he wrote Sugaree. The song was first performed live by the Grateful Dead July 31st, 1971 at the Yale Bowl at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, also debuting Mr. Charlie that day. The Dead played Sugaree 362 times in concert. Last played on July 8, 1995 at Soldier Field in Chicago. A classic rocking Dead tune, usually a first set number. I've seen it as a show opener, a first set closer, and an encore. In this clip here, they really rock it. Well, it's only a small peek at this 15-minute version. It's well worth pulling it down on archive and checking out the entire number. You won't be sorry. It's that good, and it really, really is. Before we get too far along in the show, I want to give a quick birthday shout-out to my very good buddy and marijuana legend, Blake of Argyle. Blake is a special guy who has quite an amazing talent, and it's time that the rest of the cannabis world took notice. In the meantime, he's got great stories to tell, and maybe we'll get him on the show one day to tell some of those stories. So, Blake, happy birthday. Hope you're enjoying life, and everything is going well. We'll talk with you soon. Back to our show, as the set goes on, out of Sugar Ree, the boys pull out a new Minglewood Blues and then launch into a 10-minute version of another first set standard, a song that maybe doesn't get quite enough due, but it's really a lot of fun and very good. Peggy O, let's listen. Peggy O is a great, great song. It's always listed as a traditional version. hard to say who wrote it exactly and when, but it does come up quite a lot in Grateful Dead shows. With respect to the Grateful Dead's version of it, the musical credit generally goes to Jerry. Some say Bill had a hand in writing it. Hunter may have moved around a few lyrics or two. It derives from the earlier Scottish traditional song Bonnie Lass of Fiveo. Fiveo is thought to have been a staging post between Aberdeen and Fort George in Scotland. This song does occur with a number of title variations. It's possible that Fenario, as we hear in this song, is a corruption of Fiveo. Similar traditional songs that also occurred in the UK, Handsome Polly O and Bonnie Barbara O, though these are less similar to the modern Peggy O song. The title Peggy O is used on all Grateful Dead recordings. The version of Peggy O that is included in the Jerry Garcia box set All Good Things is a previously unreleased studio recording from spring 1979 and is given the title of Fenario. The Fenario title is also used on concert recordings of the Dead and Phil Lesh and Friends. Although not released on a Dead studio album, the song was included on the remastered recordings of both Terrapin Station and Go to Heaven. The Grateful Dead first performed Peggy O on December 10th, 1973 at the Charlotte Coliseum in North Carolina. It was then played in every year through 1995, usually no more than a dozen times each year. So, you know, kind of one you had to go to a number of shows to hopefully to catch once a year, you know, more if you were looking for it. Though it was played more regularly during the 1977 to 1981 period. Ultimately, the Dead played it a total of 265 times. The last performance was on July 5th, 1995, at the Riverport Amphitheater in Maryland Heights, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis. In this clip, I really, really enjoy Jerry's strong voice, the solid jamming, and some really stealth piano contributions and fills from Keith. Again, it's a 10-minute version, so we can't really give it justice in about a minute and a half or a minute 45 clip that we play here. But it's just another reason to take an evening and, you know, download any of these albums and shows and listen to them. If you like these clips, you really have to listen to the whole thing, I think, you know, to get the full appreciation of what's going on. But Peggy O is a great tune, one that the Dead were playing not all the time, because I didn't start seeing him until 82, which was outside of that 77 to 81 window that we were just talking about a minute ago when it was getting played a little more regularly. But I remember catching it, you know, at least once a tour for the first couple of years, and then maybe not so much after that. But, you know, every now and then. It's a great story Jerry likes to tell about this dude, William O. Wright, who comes to see Peggy O., wants to marry her. Peggy O says, no, my mom won't let me. You don't have enough money. he says, oh, I do have enough money, she'd be surprised, but Peggy O says no, so he goes away and then comes back and says, you know, if ever my group returns, we're going to burn down your cities and, you know, basically destroy all your people and your land. And, you know, it's kind of a tough story, right? And then all of a sudden, for some unknown reason, William goes off and dies. So Peggy Ho is freed from that, and they all go on to live their life in Fenario happily ever after. Fenario, as you recall, is also the locale from the song Dire Wolf. And it does pop up from time to time in Grateful Dead lyrics and in stories and songs that they promote. But Peggy Ho is always a solid tune to see, always a lot of fun. I think Jerry really enjoyed telling the story. Well, I thought today, just to make sure Dan is on his toes, we'd switch it up just a little bit here. And instead of waiting till the second half of the show, let's dive into the marijuana stuff here in the first half of the show today and talk about some good marijuana stories. So anytime Dan is ready to spin that marijuana music for us for the lead-in, we're ready to do it.
I've done a bit of smuggling. I've run my share of weed. I made enough money to buy Miami. I pissed it away so fast. Never meant to last. It's never meant to last.
So that's our good friend Dave Matthews with Tim Reynolds. And Jack Johnson jumps in and they go and lead us through a version of A Pirate Looks at 40, a Jimmy Buffett song for you parrot heads out there who can't quite get enough of him. And we understand this comes from a Jack Johnson and Friends, the Best of the Kokua Festival. It's a live album by Jack Johnson, released in Germany on April 13th, 2012, and worldwide on April 17th, 2012. All songs on the album recorded live during the 6 years, 2004 through 8 and 2010, of Kokua Festivals. 100% of the profits from this release will be going to fund the Kokua Hawaii Foundation, which supports environmental art and music education around the world. The download of the album includes the bonus tracks, The Three R's. Jack dedicated the album to the Keiki, the kids of Hawaii. So, as always, a great way to go diving into our marijuana conversation. And let's start off by following up on a story that we talked about a week or two ago with Trulieve, and they were telling us how they were going to be pulling back out a pretty good chunk of change, around $13 million, as a tax refund, because they had figured out a way around 280E that they didn't really want to share with anybody else. Well, now we have TerrAscend is expecting a $26 million tax refund, again, through a 280E strategy. They're the latest marijuana multi-state operator to announce a plan to stop paying taxes owed under Section 280E of the IRS code, and an executive hinted at the company's legal basis for doing so. Executive Chair Jason Wild said the company has changed our tax position related to the applicability of Section 280E, which will result in amended returns and expected refunds of approximately $26 million. TerrAscend has reclassified $59.2 million worth of tax liabilities on its balance sheet as of the end of 2023, Chief Financial Officer Keith Stouffer said during the company's fourth quarter earnings call late Thursday of last week. These liabilities have been marked as long-term liabilities and an uncertain tax position on our balance sheet, he said. Stouffer said TerrAscend, which keeps its head office in Canada, will be filing amended tax returns for 2020, 21, and 22. The $26 million in expected tax refunds includes federal and state refunds related to tax years 2020 and 2021, Stouffer said during prepared comments. TerrAscend intends to make payments as an ordinary taxpayer going forward without taking into account 280E, he added. Questioned by an equity analyst about TerrAscend's exact legal strategy for non-payment of taxes owed under 280E, Stouffer said the company's legal interpretation is along the lines of the Buies-Schiller lawsuit and some of the legal aspects that are outlined in that lawsuit, which is in general a lawsuit that was filed by the firm it still remains unsolved. Four cannabis companies are challenging the U.S. Department of Justice over federal marijuana prohibition, claiming the Controlled Substance Act unconstitutionally interferes with state legal cannabis markets, which is something that you've heard Rob and I speak about from time to time, and that we all see as being an issue out there, in terms of the scope of federal marijuana prohibition that still is out there, most notably with 280E and the inability to get banking services, but just a lot of other things. And people are saying, you know, there's an article out there about Kamala Harris, and she's saying that we're going to get this rescheduled. And nobody's interested in what they're really doing or why. This is just clickbait for them to appeal to certain groups of people, and that's fine. At the end of the day, I guess I'd rather have it on 3 than 1, although I can't say for certain, because we don't know how the only sold by licensed pharmacist clause is going to come into play here and how that's going to be impacted. If everybody ignores it and the FDA and everybody lets everybody ignore it, well, then okay, maybe, you know, maybe it's worth taking the risk in order to get the benefits, the financial benefits of no 280E and with banking services. But, you know, we'll just have to see where this goes and how it plays out over time. And we'll hopefully be able to get some accounting experts on the show who can walk us through it with a little bit more sense of expertise than a guy like me who, you know, sits around and watches my wife do my tax returns and is damn glad she can do them. Tara sends 280E announcement comes towards the end of a cannabis earnings season dominated by buzz around marijuana companies trying to avoid 280E tax obligations. Again, Trulieve Cannabis Corp said it had already received $113 million in tax refunds after amending previous tax returns using its own undisclosed interpretation of its 280E obligations, although it's unclear whether the Florida-headquartered MSO will ultimately keep that money. New York-based Ascend Wellness Holdings has also filed amended federal tax returns and anticipates refunds, and Boca Raton headquartered Jushi Holdings said last week it has its own 280E strategy. Terra Ascend reported $86.6 million in net revenue for the quarter ended December 31, up 25.4% over the same quarter in 2022. The company posted a $41.8 million quarterly net loss from continuing operations. For all of the 2023, Terra Ascend reported net revenue of $317.3 million, up 28% year over year, and a net loss from continuing operations of $82.3 million. Terra Ascend moved its shares from the Canadian Securities Exchange to the Toronto Stock Exchange in 2023, the first of several U.S. MSOs to switch stock exchanges in Canada. So the big boys are getting tired of paying these taxes, and they're starting to flex their financial muscle a little bit here, and we'll see what kind of luck they have doing battle with the federal government. But it's nice to see that they're taking up the laboring oar on all of this, because if they can find a way to get around 280E's application to retail marijuana establishments in states with a legal program that expressly allows the dispensaries to operate, that would be a great thing. And, you know, we'll see if that's something that can be done. And, you know, we certainly hope that it can be done, because 280E remains a thorn in the side of any proprietor who wants to operate a marijuana dispensary on a retail level and finds that they can't do it because, surprise, surprise, they're basically paying tax on every dollar that came in the door, and most businesses are just not designed to operate that way. In this case, though, you know, there are a lot of marijuana companies that, even within the terms of the restrictions, are finding ways to still be able to declare profits and things like that. But you know what? Let the big boys take a swing at it. Let's see what they can come up with, and you know, we'll kind of take it from there. Number two story, that one, by the way, comes from our good friends at MJ Biz, and now we have one from Marijuana Moment. And this is big. Nevada, the state of Nevada's first legal marijuana consumption lounge, has officially opened its doors with a top local lawmaker smoking the inaugural joint at, yeah, of course, 4:20 p.m. Patrons lit up for the first time on Friday of this past week at the inaugural Thrive Cannabis Marketplace facility in Las Vegas, where they were also served a curated selection of marijuana products and non-alcoholic THC-infused beverages. This marks the culmination of years of rulemaking to allow the new license type. The Nevada Cannabis Control Board gave final approval for the Smoke and Mirrors Lounge earlier this month. Regulators approved an initial batch of consumption lounge licenses last June, which came after regulators gave preliminary approval to 40 prospective hospitality businesses. Thrive was one of the three businesses to receive that approval last year. Thrive has always been known for setting the bar for operational standards and quality cannabis experiences, and we are thrilled to be at the forefront of this historic moment in Las Vegas as we continue to revolutionize the cannabis industry, Mitch Britton, CEO of Thrive Cannabis Marketplace, said in a press release. Clark County Commissioner Tick Segerblom made history as the first person to make a legal purchase and smoke a joint at the facility at the symbolic time of 4:20 p.m. Las Vegas time. The lounge also recognized the commissioner by dedicating a signature-infused drink, The Godfather, in his honor. I've been waiting since the 1960s for this day, legally smoking marijuana in public, Segerblom told Marijuana Moment. Now Las Vegas is on its way to being the new Amsterdam, the marijuana capital of the world. Well, maybe. And that would certainly be nice. We'll have to see, where this really goes and what really happens, because still right now they make it kind of difficult to do it in any of the hotel rooms without the risk of having to pay a hugely ridiculous fine. But a little bit of time here. You got to have some faith in Vegas, and eventually, they will know where to go with this. Tyler Klimas, who served as executive director of the Nevada Cannabis Control Board from 2020 to late 2023, said in a podcast published last month that the Cannabis Consumption Lounge development represents the next frontier for the industry. The law, which was enacted under legislation from Assemblyman Steve Yeager and signed by former Governor Steve Sisolak in 2021, also allows for businesses that couple cannabis with yoga, serve infused foods, offer THC-added massage therapy, or incorporate marijuana in other ways. Sisolak touted Nevada's lounge law in a 4:20 op-ed for Marijuana Moment in 2020, writing, "The idea isn't new, but no one is doing it like we are here in Nevada." And that seems to be the case for a lot of vices in the world. Nobody ever quite does it like Nevada. While most of the consumption lounges in other states don't offer food, beverages, or other entertainment options, he said, Nevada lounges will be a one-stop entertainment shop to create jobs, grow the industry, and boost our economy. Under the board-approved rules, consumption must be hidden from public view. Smoking and vaping must take place in a separate room of the lounge or be prohibited entirely. Single-use or ready-to-consume cannabis products can't be brought off-site, and businesses must provide water to every guest free of charge. The lounge will also be cannabis only. No alcohol, tobacco, or nicotine products can be sold. Other safety-related regulations require lounges to establish plans to limit cannabis-impaired driving and minimize workers' exposures to secondhand smoke. Guns are prohibited, surveillance is required, and procedures must be in place to reduce and respond to potentially violent or harassing behavior. Well, good. That really clears things up, right? So, yes, they do have a smoking lounge, but if you want to go to the smoking lounge, you can't be in the public view. So even though you can smoke it in public, you can't really be in public. They have to build a little bullpen off to the side while everybody else is over on one side doing their thing. You and the smokers can go sit on the other side and sit there. I mean, to me, if you're going to have a smoking lounge, the whole damn place is a smoking lounge, right? Otherwise, what's the point? You don't say you go out and make all the trouble to get a smoking lounge so you can make half of it non-smoking. I think that kind of defeats the purpose of what they're trying to do here. There's plenty of places in Las Vegas you can go and get lousy food and not have to worry about smoking. So we don't need another one for that. The beauty of these things is that you can walk in there and you can smoke, and you should be allowed to bring in your own marijuana. Why should you have to pay some ridiculous price to buy whatever marijuana they're selling at this place? I think that that's just very, very important, and something that's going to have to be really addressed before this new law goes into effect and can have the impact that the sponsors are hoping it could have, right? I mean, this is, let's call it for what it is. It's just a cheap replacement for the fact that the casinos won't allow marijuana smoking on the floor. Why? I have no idea. They allow drinking all day long. People who drink get drunk and belligerent and yell at dealers and, get handsy with waitresses and all that stuff. And guys who get stoned, people who get stoned just kind of sit there, they're very matter of fact, I lost another hand, deal them up again, and before they know it, maybe they've dropped a whole much more money. So maybe not quite as good for the marijuana consumption folks in Las Vegas, but it's got to be killer for the house in terms of maximizing their abilities to win and to prevail. And what you can do, again, everything else in Vegas, you can sit those tables and you can drink like a fish all day long. They'll keep pumping you with alcohol as long as you can sit up straight. Not in all of them anymore, but in some of the casinos, you can still smoke cigarettes and cigars and all sorts of stuff. And who knows, there's probably even places down there where you can go, do lines of blow. Who the hell knows? I mean, you got people with big amounts of money spending a lot of time, and, they can go upstairs and get a call girl. They can, you know, go see strip shows. They can do it. But, you know, you can't smoke marijuana unless you're in a building and you're in a back corner of the building with no windows and no way for anybody else to see you while they sit out in the front and get treated like regular customers. You know, and as consumption lounges begin to open, the state's marijuana laws change in more meaningful ways, which is also good with this kind of a thing, including a new policy that more than double the amount of cannabis that a person can buy and possess is up now to 2.5 ounces. Recreational retailers will also become authorized to serve medical cannabis patients as well without having to get a separate license. So I think generally we can say that Nevada has been pretty pro-marijuana. Still some areas where it's lacking, and, you know, we'd like to see a little bit of improvement. But, you know, I think that they're getting there, and it would be hard to believe that at some point they will not start relaxing their rules to really make it one of the premier places to go for your THC rest and relaxation visits. You know, you want to go and do a little marijuana tourism. Yeah, you can go to Colorado. It's beautiful out there. You can hike. You can have a great time. You can do everything. You can go to California. It's gorgeous. It's whatever. You can go to Las Vegas. And, you know, although Las Vegas downtown isn't, you know, like this beautiful, you know, oasis of land, if you drive out of the city a little bit to where a lot of the cultivation centers are located, at least, it is very beautiful. Cactus and desert growth and all that kind of stuff. And why not go to Las Vegas? You've got the shows, you got all the hotels, you've got all the restaurants, you know, you've got all the everything, you know. It's still going to be a great place to go for bachelor parties. And now, if you just go out there and buy whatever marijuana you need once you arrive in time, and they got a consumption lounge where you could go smoke it. So, you know, this is all really good stuff. And, you know, I'm glad to see that Nevada's moving in that direction. We'd like to see more states doing it. There's still, to my way of thinking, absolutely no reason in the world why you can't walk into New York City and find a public place to smoke marijuana. New York is a leader in this, in cannabis, but in, you know, all forms of adult entertainment and things that small town USA may not be so likely to want to see going down in some of their establishments. But nevertheless, we take what we can get at this point, and we are grateful that things are moving in the right direction generally, and hope that they continue to do that. And maybe Kamala Harris's words will be listened to by some folks. Maybe they won't, but marijuana will make it out of the shadows on this someday. Now, I've got one more story, and I'm going to preface this by saying that this is not an April Fool's joke. This is not something that I just pulled down for laughs or to see if I could, you know, embarrass anybody or anything like that. I just call them as I see them, folks. And I'm just going to call this as I see it. Do not shoot the messenger. It comes from Marijuana Moment. We can't get mad with them either, because you know that this is where things will ultimately wind up with marijuana, because why not? So Marijuana Moment tells us that an Illinois panel that monitors what conditions will qualify a person as a patient under the state medical marijuana law have now voted to add, deep breath, female orgasmic disorder, FOD, female orgasmic disorder, as a medical marijuana qualifying condition. Known as FOD, the condition is also being weighed as a possible way for patients to qualify for medical cannabis in other states, including Ohio, New Mexico, and Connecticut. In order to be formally enacted, the Illinois Medical Cannabis Advisory Board's new recommendation will need to be approved by the State Department of Health, which oversees the patient program for medical cannabis in Illinois. Gabriella Bova, an Illinois resident who submitted the petition to add FOD to the list of qualifying conditions, told the panel at a meeting on Monday that she struggled with FOD for most of my adult life, and I became interested in cannabis as a treatment when nothing else worked for me. Another speaker, clinical sexologist Suzanne Mulvihill, founder of the Female Orgasm Research Institute, said she too was affected by FOD and went to 4 sex therapists to help resolve it before determining that cannabis helped me overcome it. Mulvihill urged the board to approve the petition so women can overcome FOD and the stigma and shame that accompany it, according to an Illinois News joint report on this week's board meeting. The body also voted to recommend adding endometriosis as a medical, a medical qualifying condition. In Ohio, meanwhile, a panel took testimony on Wednesday about a proposal for FOD as a qualifying condition, a request made by Mulvihill herself in a petition filed last year. The hearing of the state medical cannabis board drew comments from psychologists, sex therapists, and other health professionals. As a sexual assault survivor with a diagnosis of vaginismus and PTSD, I spent a significant portion of my sexually active adulthood struggling with pain, with penetration, and difficulty accessing orgasm due to my trauma, wrote Ashley Monta, a California-based sex and relationship coach. Cannabis is medicine, and for the million of women suffering from orgasmic difficulty disorder, a beacon of hope and an otherwise dreary outlook for their intimate lives, Manta continued. Cannabis made such a profound difference in my life that I became a vocal and internationally recognized advocate for utilizing cannabis to improve sexual experiences, especially for women who have a history of trauma-related disorders. Among respondents reporting orgasm difficulty, cannabis use before partnered sex increased orgasm frequency 72.8%, improved orgasm satisfaction 67%, or made orgasm easier 71%, the study found. As commentators told officials in Illinois this week, the study also found that FOD is associated with a number of other mental health conditions. Well, yeah, maybe that might make sense. Women with FOD reported 24% more mental health issues, 52.6% more PTSD, 29% more depressive disorders, 13% more anxiety disorders, and 22% more prescription drug use than women without FOD. Women with FOD were more likely to report sexual abuse history than women without FOD. So I think that's enough. We don't have to get too much deeper into this article. But yeah, this is, you can't make stuff like this up. I wouldn't even try. But Illinois, of all places, is going to be one of the leaders in recognizing female orgasmic disorder. So if it's you, or if you have a friend or a partner or whoever, you can take a look at that. Gives you another way into the program, and who knows what it might do for your sex life. Back in college, we always thought it was great stuff. As adults, we do it. We fall asleep before we can get anything done. So, you know, you got to watch that too. But back to our concert. From lovely Winterland 47 years ago today. And now we're about to hit a couple of clips here that I'm pulling out that to me are just really, really, really cool parts of this show and two of the primary reasons why we selected today's show from a list of many others that we'll go through in a minute. But let's go ahead and hear this very familiar tune. Fire on the Mountain, again a Hunter Hart, not a Hunter Garcia tune, released on Shakedown Street, which was released on November 8th, 1978, as the last song on the first side of the album. This is the first time it was ever played, right here. Right here. And one of the reasons I chose this show over a number of other great shows on the same date, including a Smokin' Early Dead show in 1967, also at Winterland, and 1971 at the Fox Theater in St. Louis, coming fast on the heels of the Dead's epic six-night Capitol Theater run in Port Chester in late February of that year. We featured one of those shows just a couple of weeks ago. But this is just another one of those songs with a long and complicated Genesis story, perhaps not worth getting into too much detail about here, but the rough outlines at least are important to note. The lyrics, according to Robert Hunter in Box of Rain, were written at Mickey Hart's ranch in heated inspiration as the surrounding hills blazed and the fire approached the recording studio where we were working. Hart, credited with the music for the song, recorded a proto-rap version for an unreleased album entitled Area Code 415, recorded in 1972 and 73. It was also included on a Mickey Hart album entitled Fired on the Mountain, recorded in 1973-74. It appeared as an instrumental entitled Happiness is Drumming on Hart's 1976 studio album, Diga. And it finally began showing up in the Grateful Dead repertoire, sung by Jerry Garcia in 1977 on this date, undergoing a number of variants of the lyrics until it settled into the format that was eventually recorded and released on Shakedown Street in November 1978. There's a lot of other detail I haven't mentioned, possibly worthy of some historian taking it apart piece by piece, but you get the rough idea. On March 18, 1977, at Winterland Arena, San Francisco, Fire appeared for the first time, closing the first set, followed by its eternal partner, its eternal partner, Scarlet Begonias. Thus, not only the first Fire, but the first combination of these tunes, which frequently enclosed some wonderful jamming and came to be known in the Dead world as a Scarlet Fire set opener, a Scarlet Fire jam. We're melting Scarlet Begonias into Fire on the Mountain, and it's a wonderful thing. There were a handful of occasions on which Fire appeared without Scarlet Begonias, but not many, approximately 15 out of 253 total performances. It remained steadily in the repertoire from 1977 and was played for the final time on July 2nd, 1995 at the Deer Creek Music Center in Noblesville, Indiana. This clip being the song's first live performance and almost a year and a half before its commercial release, there are noticeable differences between it and the one we all know and love. But they go there very quickly, as only 2 months later, on May 8, 1977, the Dead played the Barton Hall show that many declare to be the best show ever. While that may or may not be true, what is true is that that version of Scarlet Fire is awesome and certainly befitting a show many do consider to be the finest Dead show of all time. So it didn't take them long to really nail this down and get Fire on the Mountain to a place where they wanted it to be and where the fans love it being. There were many more to follow. The lucky ones who were in Winterland this night, however, got to witness how it all started, and that's very cool. And I love picking up little things like that for the listeners when we're going through this stuff, and that's just really too good to pass up. It still sounds like a very solid Fire. It's a little rough around the edges. They're still working some things out. Donna G's in there wailing a little too early for my taste, but nevertheless, she seems to overly be a plus for the song, and that's a good thing too. But you know, it's always nice to find the genesis of these, institutional classics. You know, the pillars of the Grateful Dead: Scarlet Fire, Help on the Way, Slipknot, Franklin's, a Help Slip Frank opener, a China Rider, Right for China Cat, I Know You Rider. Any of these, an Estimated Eyes, Estimated Profit into Eyes of the World. But somehow Scarlet Fire was just always a special one. Whether you saw him do it as a show opener, in this instance, it's played as a first set closer. And I don't know how many times that ever occurred, to be honest with you. When I saw it, it was either a second set opener, or on two occasions, once in Chicago and once at a New Year's show, they came out and opened the show with Scarlet Begonias into Scarlet Fire. Sugar Magnolia into Scarlet Fire, and that was always a great thing to see as well. So Fire on the Mountain, great tune, good buddy, Harold's favorite Grateful Dead song, and well, it should be. Now, this is even cooler what we're about to talk about, because we've all heard Fire on the Mountain, hopefully lots of times, for those of us that are so inclined to go to as many Grateful Dead or Dead-related shows as is possible for us to go to. But this is just about a month removed from the Grateful Dead's debut at the Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino, California, of Terrapin Station. We just featured that a week or two ago on the anniversary of that memorial show. And that launched the beginning and the future and everything of the Dead's live version of two parts of the seven-part Terrapin Suite. So the part that we're all used to hearing is called Lady with a Fan into Terrapin Station. And then they have all the other little parts along the way. And traditionally, the Dead only played the first two parts of the song in concert, and it would still be stretched out 15, 16 minutes sometimes, which, you know, was fine. We never got to hear the rest of it. And on the album, I happen to think that it's all very, very beautiful when they finally do get to the entire suite, which is exactly Lady with a Fan, Terrapin Station, Terrapin, Terrapin Transit, At a Siding, Terrapin Flyer, and Refrain. And on this night, just a month or two removed from the debut of Terrapin Station, Jerry and the boys decided to push the envelope just a little bit, and they stuck a toe into the water of the rest of the suite and sampled out one of the other five parts for a minute. And so let's listen to it. We'll see if you can figure out what it is, and then we'll talk more about it on the back end. So this relatively short little clip that they played out of Terrapin Station and then into the next part of the show, they kind of use it as a bridge into the drums, is amazing. And it's another reason why I chose this show for today's episode. This represents the only known instance of the Dead playing the Terrapin Flyer part of the full Terrapin Suite from the Terrapin Station album. Released on July 27th, 1977, coming out of the traditional parts at the very beginning that we talked about, Lady with a Fan and Terrapin Station. Although Jerry does not sing the lyrics from this part of the suite, he jams at a very distinctive melody. Interestingly, this is only a few weeks, as we said, after the debut of Terrapin at the Swing Auditorium on February 26, 1977. Here, the Dead were trying out this sixth of seven parts of the suite, and for whatever reason did not like what they heard, or didn't enjoy playing it, or more likely practicing it, so it was dropped from the live performances, even though the primary and opening parts of the suite, Lady with a Fan into Terrapin Station, went on to be played a total of over 300 times, 303 times. These are the fun little discoveries, you know, that even after 40 plus years of listening to, following, attending Dead concerts, learning about the band, that keep it fun, interesting, and amazing. I'm checking out this show to decide if this is a show that you know, I want to feature. And in fact, on the set list out of Terrapin Station, it's listed as Alhambra and then drums. And Alhambra is one of the many jams that the Dead do, the Alhambra jam, like the Mind Left Body jam and some of the others that we've talked about in the past. And drums are drums. But in fact, Alhambra is not Alhambra in this instance. Alhambra is what we just heard, Terrapin Flyer. So even just by looking at the set list, you might miss it. So I always read the comments at the bottom of these pages where you can go to get archive.org on the internet, and this is where they start writing about it. And then they say, "Oh, who noticed it? You know, the Terrapin Flyer." And yeah, no, I can't find any other part of it where they ever played this extra part of it. So to me, that just makes it a lot cooler and more fun and more interesting. And hopefully, it does for you too. As for the recording of the entire suite, Keith Olsen was chosen by the band to produce, and the band temporarily moved to Los Angeles, as Olsen preferred to work at Sound City, where he had recently achieved success producing Fleetwood Mac's 1975 comeback album. Olsen had a method for reining in the Dead. During the cutting of the basic tracks, it was pretty hard to get every member of the band in the studio at the same time, he said. So Steve Parrish went out to the hardware store and got these giant nails and a great big hammer. And as soon as everybody was in, he hammered the door shut from the inside. We didn't have drifters from the other studios coming in to listen. We didn't have people leaving to go screw around elsewhere. We started getting work done. With Fleetwood Mac, Olsen had a hands-on approach orchestrating the addition of Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks in influencing song choices, arrangements, and sequencing. He entered the Grateful Dead project with similar expectations, imagining a concept album or song cycle. Olsen said that Davis told him, "I need a commercial record out of them." This caused some friction during the sessions, as well as with the end results. Kreutzmann said he'd have us play the same thing over and over again, and we're not really the type of band that can put up with that. Our very identity is based on the opposite principle. So this is the story behind the story, right? When we want to find out what's going on with the rest of the Terrapin suite, you know, for all these years, from 77 to 95, so what, 18 more years, they never quite got around to playing it again. They never quite, decided that it was something that they wanted to do. And it's too bad. You know, we're all the worse for it. But luckily, we do have this recording, and it allows us to go back and listen to this. And the whole thing is great. I very strongly recommend it again. And just go back and listen to the Terrapin Station album, and I think you'll find that it's really a lot of fun, and there's a lot of stuff going on with that. So two very cool moments from the show. We still have two more clips to go, but this time, since I'm flip-flopping with the marijuana news, we're going to dive into some quick music news for a minute. And the always handy Dan has come up with a new intro for this start of the episode of the podcast. So go ahead, Dan, and let's hear what you got for us. This is my stealth favorite Who's tune, right? Yeah, Won't Get Fooled Again, Baba O'Reilly, you know, the list goes on and on and on of amazing Behind Blue Eyes, of just all of these great songs that they played. But there was something about Long Live Rock. It was just right out of the box, hard-nosed rock and roll coming right at you. It's featured from the Kids Are All Right album, which, of course, the Kids Are All Right is the, you know, kind of live documentary type movie made about The Who that was, you know, mandatory viewing for all of us back senior year of high school and freshman year of college. That was the first time I saw The Who on their tour in April. They came through St. Louis 1980, and it was just an extension of the tour that December 10 people had died in the stampede at Cincinnati trying to get into the show. So, but for me, I always call it my first big boy rock and roll show. And it was just absolutely amazing, amazing, amazing. And Long Live Rock is a great tune. So hats off to Dan for coming out with that one. And on the music side, you know, there's always so much music going on in the rock and world. It's hard to keep up with all of it. Goose has announced some new shows up at the Capitol Theater in Port Washington to introduce their new drummer. I apologize, I forget his name. I think I want to say it's Kotler or something like that. But we'll have it because eventually we'll swing back around to Goose and we'll talk about them and we'll talk about their new drummer. But they're out there playing. I heard, read an article that says Bobby and Phil are going to be touring. They make it sound like it's the first time they've ever done it, but a few years back, they actually came through Chicago. They played a few cities, the two of them, and really, really excellent shows, I thought. Really a lot of fun to see. And how cool is it to see those two guys, you know, up on a stage together doing their thing and, you know, brothers practically. And it's, you know, with the long history that they had and everything else, it's just wonderful to see them playing with one another again and, you know, kind of revisiting and all of their, you know, their prior musical moments and pulling out the stuff they wanted. And yeah, here we go, right here. Bobby and Phil, Chicago Theater, March 10th, 2018. You know, great opening with Box of Rain, Ramble on Rose, Cosmic Charlie, Looks Like Rain, Estimated Profit, Operator, West LA. And that was just Bobby and Phil out for that one. And then in the second set, we got Jeff Cementi, Larry Campbell, and Teresa Williams, and playing in the band, playing Reprise, Scarlet, Fire, Dark Star, St. Stephen, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, Birdsong, Sugar Mag, Sunshine, Daydream. And then the Encore U.S. Blues. So, you know, they've done this before. They're doing it again. Once again, this is a must-see pairing. You know, whether you like Wolf Brothers, whether you like Dead & Co., whether you like Phil and Friends, it just doesn't matter because when you get these two guys together, the guys who made so much magic together on stage for so long, I think it's really special and really something that anyone who has a strong history or a strong relationship with the Grateful Dead and listening to their music should take advantage. We don't know how much longer these guys will be able to make this music together. Phil, we know, is getting, you know, significantly older now, 84, significantly slowing down, and we hope he plays forever, but that's probably not going to happen. So Bobby and Phil coming soon to a theater near you. Check it out. On the fish circuit, I'm drowning in fish, folks. I got to tell you, I just found out I got 3 tickets for the shows at Alpine Valley the last weekend in July. Then I've got tickets for the 2 shows in St. Louis that immediately follow that. So they'll be playing July 26th, 27th, and 28th, and then shooting down to St. Louis for the 30th and the 31st. Unfortunately, I will not be able to then follow them to Deer Creek on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, or up to Grand Rapids on the 6th and 7th, because especially those shows between August 1st and August 8th will fall on the days between Jerry's birth on August 1st and his death on August 9th. And there was a time in the past when one of those days between, Fish pulled out its one and only performance of Terrapin Station. So you always got to keep your eyes peeled for a little Fish Grateful Dead action. But in the meantime, I'll be catching 5 shows not too far from my house. And then I will also be going out to Mondegreen in Delaware for the Big Fish Festival in the middle of August. And we will be doing a lot of reporting leading up to it and from the campsite and maybe even from the concert area itself, depending on how they have it all set up. But a lot of Fish, looking forward to catching them this summer and just having a fun summer of live music. I'm in the process of trying to put together some plans to make it out to Las Vegas for 1 or 2 of the Dead & Company shows at the Sphere and really live that experience up a little bit and, you know, find out what it's all about. And why not? It's my band, and this is one of the cooler venues now to see people in. I'm not going to be able to get in to see Fish, so if I can get there, I got to go. But we'll talk about that too as time goes on. So, you know, not a lot of music news there, but there's stuff going on. Neil Young is coming through Chicago this summer. A whole group of us are going to get tickets and go out and see Neil. Very excited to see him in concert live and coming out. And, you know, you go on YouTube and just watch some of the stuff that he does and that he covers with some of the other rock and roll musicians out there. And it's nothing short of just fantastic. You know, if you're a Neil Young fan, you're going to go crazy over it. And even if you're not a huge Neil Young fan, you're going to go crazy over it because there's just something about his kind of nitty-gritty style of rock and roll when he really gets down and dirty with it that's such a pleasure to listen to. And just as a shout-out to that respect, if you haven't seen it, there's a clip on YouTube from a year and a half, maybe even longer, And I can't remember if he comes out and plays with Fish or if Trey comes out and plays with him. But they launch into what turns out to be an 18-minute version of Neil's Down by the River. And, folks, it's just, it's solid rock and roll. It brings a tear to the eye to just hear Neil throwing it down on this. Trey keeping up with him, you know, no problem, because that's just what Trey does. And between the two of them, it just gets batted around and played, and it's really, really good stuff. So, having an opportunity to see Neil is always fun, so look forward to doing that. And, you know, we'll see what else is going around out there. We'll have plenty of good music to talk about this summer. We'll have plenty of good concerts that are happening that we're going to get to or that we're going to hear about, from our friends at Fish and a lot of the other jam bands, and we'll see exactly what kind of shows and how many shows we get out of Dead and Company folk, and we'll want to keep an eye on that. So now, as we cycle back in for the final clips from our music show in lovely San Francisco, March 18th, 1977, 47 years ago today, we're going to dive into a song that was probably played as much, if not more, than just about any other song by the Grateful Dead during their concert career. Everybody knows it. Hopefully they love it. Here it is. Not Fade Away, everybody knows that song, written by Buddy Holly and Norman Petty. Holly and the Crickets recorded the song in Clovis, New Mexico on May 27, 1957, and it was released as a single, the B-side to Oh Boy, on October 27, 1957 on the Brunswick label. The rhythmic pattern of Not Fade Away is a variant of the Bo Diddley beat, with the second stress occurring on the second rather than the third beat of the first measure, which was an update of the hambone rhythm, or padded juba, from West Africa. Jerry Allison, the drummer for the Crickets, pounded out the beat on a cardboard box. Allison, Holly's best friend, wrote some of the lyrics, though his name never appeared in the songwriting credits. Joe Malden played the double bass on this recording. It is likely that the backing vocals were Holly, Allison, and Nicky Sullivan, but this is not known for certain. It was first played by the Grateful Dead on February 19, 1969, at the Fillmore West in San Francisco. It was played by the band a total of 561 times and last played on July 5th, 1995 at the Riverport Amphitheater just outside of St. Louis. This is an absolute ripping version of this tune, so much so that I blew off the lyrics and just had to feature the jam. Everyone knows the lyrics, but the jam in this 20-plus minute version is better than anything in singing I could have featured. It's just, they just tear it apart. And yes, they still sing the parts at the beginning and the end, and, you know, life is, love is bigger than a Cadillac, and yada, yada, yada. But it's just listening to Jerry, you know, as he just ramps it up and higher, higher, and higher there at the end before falling back into the regular beat for the song and really pounding it out. So a wonderful Not Fade Away. It gets played a lot, and so sometimes, you know, due to that regularity, you can kind of start to take it for granted. I know I used to from time to time, especially after they paired it with Throwing Stones. So in the second set after the drums, as soon as you heard the opening notes to Throwing Stones, you knew it was that and Did Not Fade Away into See You Later, Bubba. And I was like, damn it, don't be so predictable all the time. Because when I first started seeing them, Not Fade Away could pop up kind of anywhere. And many times it would be paired up with Going Down the Road Feeling Bad, which was a wonderful thing. But, you know, they had their ways, and that's the way they did it. You know, Not Fade Away. But this 20-minute version, again, is really, really excellent. And, you know, another key component of this very fine show from Winterland. But we have run out of time again. It seems to always go by very, very fast. So before we shove off here with our final song, which I'll get to in 1 minute, I just want to say that we've been talking about having guests for a while, and now we're going to hopefully kind of open the floodgates on that. And starting with next week's show, I invite you back to hear from Nick Erickson of Full Moon Farms, a cultivator up in the Humboldt Emerald Triangle area, a legacy grower and also a huge live music fan, who came of age more towards the end of the Grateful Dead's run, but at least he saw the Grateful Dead live, saw some other great bands live, and just has some really great stories about growing cannabis, especially, you know, in a legacy situation. About seeing the Grateful Dead, about seeing a lot of other great bands, about enjoying the cannabis with so many of these people in the rock and roll world. And we're looking forward to having Nick on the show next week. So please, please listen in, tell your friends, and hear some great stuff. We focus so much on the Grateful Dead and music on this show, and rightfully so. But every now and then it's good to have a day or two that, you know, really kind of pushes back a little bit and reminds us of the marijuana side and what things are really all about with that. And you know, how lucky we are to have such amazing cultivators out there, guys like Nick and everyone else who take the risk so the rest of us can enjoy the fruits of their labor. So please pop in next week, and we will be interviewing Nick Erickson, and it will be a very, very interesting and fun show. We're going to go out today with the song Around and Around. Now, this is not the final song of the set. They play one more after this, Uncle John's Band, and call it a night. But we've heard Uncle John's a lot, and even though we've listened to Around and Around from time to time, this, again, continuing in the theme of this show, is just under 9 minutes, which is a long time for Around and Around, and really, really a high energy volume version that really, I think, just moves, and you'll hear it on the clip as we go out here. And it's very appropriate to end with a Chuck Berry tune. Now, I think, you know, you might have heard me say that the show itself, we're listening to today, opened with Promised Land, another Chuck Berry tune. And then, you know, the second to last tune is a Chuck Berry tune, Around and Around, March 18th, little did they know, fast forward to 1990, but that is actually the date of Chuck Berry's death. So today represents the 7th anniversary of Chuck's death in 17, at the age of 90. And for those of us who were lucky to see Chuck down the stretch there, at the end, he's a St. Louis guy, and he would always do one show a month at Blueberry Hill in the Loop in University City, St. Louis. And when I was in town, we'd always try to go down there and see it, because why not? A living legend like that, basically doing small bar shows just because he still liked to play and it was close to home and easy for him to do. Around and Around is a 1958 rock song that he wrote. It originally appeared under the name Around and Around with an ampersand rather than A-N-D. As the B-side to the single Johnny Be Good. That's pretty damn good company to be released in the world in. Was released on March 31st, 1958 on Chicago's own Chess Records, and checking in at a brisk 2 minutes and 20 seconds. Many bands have covered the song, including most famously the Rolling Stones and David Bowie, and of course, The Dead, who played it 418 times. They didn't just cover it. Like most of these tunes, they kind of took ownership of it practically. They played it for the first time on November 8th, 1970 at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester. God, we hear about that place a lot. And lastly, on July 6th, 1995 at the Riverport Amphitheater, just outside of St. Louis. Again, we hear about this place a lot. It's very appropriate since Chuck was born in St. Louis and died in Wentzville, which is just a stone's throw outside of the city limits. This is one of the better versions of the tune that I have heard, because not only does it check in, it jumps under 9 minutes, but the boys jam it out, throw a few false endings in, and finally wrap it up. You know, sometimes I felt like they almost went into default mode when they got to Around and Around and played it, but not with the same energy, you know, that it demanded to be played with. And in this version here, boy, they come out smoking on it, and they just play it really, really well. You know, it gets followed up by Uncle John's band, and then the boys say goodnight to Winterland Crazies and head home for a rare post-show night in their own beds, which I'm sure for them must have always been nice. You know, you can hear it sometimes in the confidence of playing, knowing that you're not about to head back out on the road or catch a late-night flight or sit in a bus for the next 24 hours or whatever the case may be. But either way, good for them. Everyone, thank you so much for listening and tuning in again. We really appreciate all of our listeners. We hope that you're spreading the word of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. Last week, although we didn't make a big deal about it, and maybe we will down the road, but, you know, we're not always into that kind of thing, was our 250th episode. So there is more than enough episodes out there for all of you to be listening to, you know, and you can catch up with all of them. If you have questions you want to ask us, or contributions or comments, or just tell me, hey, moron, you fucked up, please go right ahead. We love it when people write in and want to communicate with us. If you have any ideas for good stories or people who you think would make good interviews, let me know, let Dan Humiston know, and that would be fantastic. But really, thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. Enjoy Around and Around. Have a great week. Be safe. And as always, enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thanks, everyone.
Listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Infused, a cannabis talk show, is a one-of-a-kind look inside the cannabis industry. Meet the amazing people who make cannabis businesses bloom as they join host Nick with Francesca and Mike for creative cannabis conversations. Get an honest look at the business of cannabis, including trends, best and worst practices, products, education, and advocacy. Whether you're canna curious or running a cannabis, Infused has canna conversations that count. Infused is available on YouTube and is now streaming as part of the PodConnects Network.